Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You think the Roma shit was nuts last week? Newcastle would be insane.
It is Monday, which means it's time for the Front Three Weekend Review Podcast. Your Front Three this week is me, Adam Bowen. It's the one and only Chris Hennage.
Good afternoon.
And Nick Morales as well.
I'm always last on the intros, Adam. What is that?
Apologies. You'll be first next time. I'll make a note of that. But you should be happy anyway, Nico. Don't be worried about that, because Man City are champions. You should be delighted.
I am delighted. I had a blueberry bagel on Sunday.
What a way to celebrate. The only way to celebrate, many would say. A week earlier, perhaps, than many expected. I think we were thinking Gualio's team might have to secure the necessary 3 points against Swansea next weekend. But it turns out Jay Rodriguez did it for Manchester City in the end.
I knew I always liked him for a reason.
You know? Exactly.
There was something about him. I was like, Jay Rodriguez is probably a good guy. He gives us a title. Great.
We are going to be talking about Man City, the new Premier League champions, of course. We're going to be talking about Newcastle United, who pretty much secured their safety in the Premier League with a win over Arsenal this weekend. We're also going to be giving our reactions to the Champions League draw from last Friday and talking any other business from the world of football. But let's start with Manchester City, Nico, as we're talking about here, Premier League champions for the third time, their fifth English title overall. Let's talk a little bit about the game, essentially, the 3 points against Spurs, which got them that trophy. How did you see this game going? I mean, 3-1 in the end. City were all over Spurs in the opening period. I think it was 2-0 after, 17, 18 minutes? Spurs sort of worked their way back into it, but in the end, City are class above, and there was only ever going to be one winner.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always nervous when it comes to playing Spurs, especially under the recent incarnations of Pochettino, because he's just really good manager, and the pressing style tends to not go so well for Guardiola football, as I'm sure we'll talk about in a little bit. But yeah, I think the ball progression was really good in this game for Manchester City, and that's really the key. I'm writing something currently about sort of the reason why they lost three games in a row after, you know, being really, really good all season. And it mainly comes down to the midfield and how they progress the ball. I think sort of shortly, the Tottenham got caught in a halfway house between sort of mid-block pressing, which is just pressing in the middle of the field and waiting till the ball gets to the midfield to do so, and high pressing. If you look at the Sanchez goal, the Davinson Sanchez goal, or the one where he kind of was isolated, a lot of people blaming him for that, maybe saying he switched off, but that's not necessarily the case, because you know, what you have to do when you play that high of a line, the reason that you do so is to make the effective size of the pitch really small so that your pressing actions are more effective. And so if you do that and you hold that high of a line, you give attackers like Jesus and Sterling and De Bruyne and all those guys that much space to run into or possibly run into. You have to put pressure on the people who have the ball. And Vincent Kompany had a ton of time and space to pick out that ball. So you can't really fault Davinson Sanchez for failing there. And I think that was sort of the theme throughout the game, was that they got caught between those two mindsets of pressing high and pressing in the middle of the field. And the ball progression, David Silva, Kevin De Bruyne finding space to expose, you know, the defenders, Tottenham's defenders one-on-one, and kind of getting Leroy Sané in behind Trippier and all those guys. That was the theme of the game. And I think they just didn't do enough in that respect to cover themselves. And when you concede that many chances to Manchester City, it's just not going to go well, especially this season. So I think that's kind of the reason why that it was 3-1.
It's interesting. I think, the pressing of the opposition on the ball combined with that very high defensive line as well led to that goal that we saw. It was interesting, that goal. I mean, Chris, Nico speaks there of how maybe Sanchez doesn't deserve the criticism he's been getting after the game. a lot of Spurs fans turning their focus towards the absence of Toby Alderweireld, of course, who, yes, has been coming back from injury, but who Pochettino seems intent to not bring back into this side, given the contract issues that we know are going on in the background. But yet many Spurs fans want to see him back in this team.
The difficulty in doing that is that it goes against the history of how he's usually handled these situations. You look at sort of Kyle Walker, a little bit kind of towards Danny Rose. Those were examples where someone sort of broke ranks, if you will, and was then subsequently ostracized for a period. I think he himself will know that Alderweireld is unlikely to be able to win his way back in, because I think Alderweireld probably wants to go. And I think, look, the problem Sanchez has as a defender is that he is incredibly young. He's coming into his first season, and there are times he looks absolutely fantastic and every single penny well spent. I do have certain concerns with him sometimes, though. He just gives me a little bit of a wobbly feeling, just in terms of his maybe decision-making, sort of his tendency to be a little bit over-aggressive. That is, because that is such a fine line to try and play, I think. But I think the idea of bringing Alderweireld back in, I just wonder if that perhaps sends the wrong message to those around him, in terms of, you know, you can not win your way back in, but, you know, I will bend to the pressure of necessity over having a principle. And I think that's the thing with Poch, is that he has these very obvious set of principles that he doesn't like to wane from.
I think the difficulty there, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this as well, Adam, is that the difficulty with losing someone like Alderweireld, though you have replacements kind of ready, like Davinson Sanchez, is that he is by far and away their best, or I think some people would struggle to say their best player. But you miss so much when you don't have Alderweireld in the team, not just from a defensive standpoint. Ashwin Rahman, who's a really good data analyst, right before the game actually put out a sort of a chart plotting, you know, how efficient some of the center backs in the Premier League are at completing different types of passes. And in both short range and long range passing, Toby Alderweireld stood out like far above everyone else. And that's the dynamism you miss, is that he has the ability to be an excellent defender and command a high line and be the basis of those pressing actions that we talked a little bit about, Spurs both being good and bad at those things, but also the directness to Kane, the ability to bypass the midfield when Spurs don't have the ability to hold the ball, and all of those things. That's what Sanchez is missing. There's a ton of evidence to believe that he, an extremely capable defender, can advance himself in those kind of capabilities, his ability to be similar to Alderweireld in that sense. But without Toby, you miss such a key part of this team, which has been the directness to Kane and other forward attackers, that I think is going to be a huge problem for Spurs going forward if they do in fact end up selling Alderweireld to somebody else.
Yeah, I think as Chris is sort of saying, Pochettino's whole approach is my way or the highway, and I think it's proved incredibly effective, and you can't really argue with how he's implemented that. I mean, I remember when he came, there was so much dead wood he had to get rid of, and he's obviously moulded this squad into one that can compete at the top end of the table. The Alderweireld situation is different because I think he's the first sort of player who, I think, as you sort of say, Nico, could be classed among the best of the Spurs players, the elite in that squad. At the same time, I think what's sort of placated any frustration from Spurs fans is the run Spurs have been on. You know, this defeat does, I think, not raise questions, but it does highlight whether Davinson Sanchez is quite ready to step into Alderweireld's shoes. I think they're different players, as you point out. There's qualities that Alderweireld brings that Sanchez doesn't have. I think it's going to be interesting to see how Pochettino deals with this situation this summer, it does look like Alderweireld's gone, but who he's going to bring in as a replacement, whether he looks for a player with the qualities of Alderweireld, how much money we can get for Alderweireld, and therefore how much we can spend. I think it's also a potentially interesting question in that defence with Hugo Lloris. He made another error, potentially. I know it wasn't actually a penalty. There was a mistake by John Moss to award
was
the spot kick.
Was it a mistake?
I don't think it was a penalty. It was outside the box, right? The challenge?
I don't know about that, Adam.
The contact?
We'll let that slide. No, we'll let it slide.
But either one way or the other, it's Lloris gave away that foul, whether it was a penalty or not. And I think, you know, there have been growing concerns among Spurs fans about his form in recent weeks. There's been too many mistakes from him. Whether that means, you know, Pochettino will look to phase him out, I think it would be a shame if that's the case, because he's obviously an incredibly experienced and talented player. I think he seems to be just lacking a little confidence at the moment.
I mean, he is starting to regress, and for me, I think the biggest thing is that he is getting older, and he never really had the biggest thing that I think a lot of analysts would criticize with Lloris is that his tactical application in a team that needs to possess the ball more and more is lacking. He doesn't have the ability with his feet, and that's partially why someone like Gazzaniga was brought in, was because you have those instances where you need a goalkeeper to have the ball with his feet. So I think that's the biggest thing, is that Hugo, from his best aspects in terms of shot stopping, is starting to regress, and he never had the other aspects to begin with. So that's the difficult position that they're
playing. I'd agree with that. When Lloris says, as the ball is for you, never know where it's going to go. But at the same time, I think a lot of Spurs fans are calling for Vorm to be in goal for the FA Cup semi-final next weekend against Manchester United. Not quite sure I agree with that. But, you know, perhaps we are seeing the beginning of the end of Lloris as the Spurs number one, for sure.
I do wonder as well if Alderweireld isn't slightly influenced by Lloris, in so much as for a few years we talked about Lloris potentially leaving and going to a Champions League club, and now the debate has 180 in so much as the talk is maybe it's time to replace him, and Alderweireld is aware that, you know, a loyalty will only stretch so far in a Spurs side this ambitious, so I need to actually think about myself first.
We do need to talk about the champions, Nico. I mean, I mentioned it earlier, it was 2-0, City were dominant, there was that spell, Spurs grabbing the goal just before half time, and in the second half they were pushing for that equaliser, but in the end, I mean, City looked a class above, and I think it put to rest any questions that there could have been about this side. There was that idea that, you know, losing two legs in the Champions League to Liverpool, losing in the manner they did against Manchester United, some were questioning the level of this team based on those failures. What are your thoughts on their titles win? Do you think we're sort of undermining what has been an incredible season from Guardiola based on results over the course of 7 days?
Yeah, and as well as the fact that I think the title win was always going to be undermined if he didn't do well in the Champions League. And that's the thing that I think has been both pointed out to me, and the point that I've made on Twitter a few times, is that Guardiola's had three jobs at the highest level of football: Barcelona, Bayern Munich, and Manchester City. In none of those situations has he had the ability to overperform his circumstances, or his resources, rather. So, you know, with Pochettino, you can say, maybe if he had the Manchester City or United money, he'd be able to do the same things that they are, when you have these other coaches that are in lesser situations. But with Guardiola, he is always either performing par or underperforming his expectations. And I think sometimes, you know, we're talking about the criticism people had of Guardiola before he came to England was, okay, well, he probably wouldn't be able to do it in the Premier League. And to be fair, he didn't win anything in his first year at Manchester City. But now that he has, the two things that we're hearing is he spent $1 billion, and, you know, he had the best squad in the league, so it doesn't mean that much anyways. It seems like we're always going to have this underappreciation of what he's doing, despite the fact that not only is he winning the Premier League in record time, I believe, or maybe not record time, but certainly earlier than most titles are won.
I think he's 2 days off. I think the record was April 14th, so he's 1 day off, I should say.
Right. So he's winning it near record time. He's probably going to break a few records by the end of the season in terms of goals scored, points accrued, and stuff like that. And people are still like, well, maybe not. You know, maybe he's not that good. So I think we're kind of...
Yeah, those achievements, Chris, do they not speak volumes about the quality of this team, the fact that they probably will break the record points tally in the Premier League, the most goals scored, etc.? Surely that's the proof that we can rank these one of the best teams in Premier League history.
I'm kind of reminded of a conversation Don Revie and Brian Clough had many years ago. I don't know if you ever saw this, Adam. This might be way before your time, Nico. I mean, technically it's before all our time, but there's a conversation where Revie's won the league with Leeds, and Clough talks about what he wanted to do with Leeds having just been sacked. And he tells Revie, I wanted to win the league. I wanted to do better. I wanted to lose less games. And Revie was so kind of like befuddled by the notion of that I think this is kind of what Guardiola's doing. He's winning the league, but he's doing it better than other people have done it. And so there's an achievement in that, of course there is. And there's a brilliance about the way they played, the fact that he stuck to his principles, the fact that he didn't necessarily try and bend to English football. He maintained what he thought was the best way to do it. And that has delivered them a league title in fairly, you know, good time with games to go. There's still further records to be achieved, obviously. I think the thing with him now is that because he sits at the top of management in that sense, or in the top bracket, and because he also has invested a good amount of money in this team, I don't think, you know, he sits alone on that. Mourinho's done it too. They needed change. That's a whole other discussion. There's an element now that the Champions League almost has to be the next big white whale for them to attack, because City really want it. It's kind of been, I think, one of their biggest desires from the moment this new era of City emerged, when they tried to sign Kaká and all that. The Champions League was validation. The Premier League was great. It appeased the fans in so many ways, and I understand why. But the Champions League was going to announce them on the stage in the same way it would for PSG. So I think, yeah, this is fantastic. It's just the idea that maybe we're slowly developing a new interpretation of what Guardiola is, because he hasn't stayed at Bayern Munich for a long time. I see some very tentative talk about whether he'll stay at City very long time. And it's this idea that he comes and he puts his mark and then he leaves. But I think for City, maybe they wanted something a little bit more. I mean, I give him credit. He's installing so many ideas and philosophies that I don't think every club in the top six is doing, without wishing to go into detail on each one. And I think, yeah, that's what's next now, is he has to go for the Champions League and try and do that.
But do you think we – I mean, I'll pose this question to the both of you. Do you think we place far too much weight on the Champions League and winning it? Because I think – We can't forget that, you know, Bayern Munich did not fire Pep Guardiola. They were actually willing to offer him a new contract. They were just waiting on his decision as to whether he wanted to stay for more time. And then he chose to take the Manchester City job publicly in that December and whatnot. I think sometimes we put too much weight on the Champions League, and Guardiola said this in a recent press conference as well, is that, you know, you have to be consistent over 38 games or less or more, whatever, in order to win a league. You have to be consistent. And in the Champions League, you can be lucky with the draw. The Roma tie, for example, I mean, Barcelona beat them heavy-handedly in the first tie, and maybe, you know, they were definitely the better team in the second leg, but you play that game 9 times, you know, you play that game 10 times over, and I think you take Barcelona and they probably perform differently every single other time. So it's a competition that there's an immense degree of randomness to it, and a league competition has much more of a I don't know, precise way of saying, okay, this is by far and away been the most consistent and best team in the league. I think sometimes because of the aura of the Champions League, and I'm trying to undervalue it to any extent, because I think the teams that have won it and teams that have won both the league and Champions League competitions are elite, and we should remember them. But I think sometimes we place far too much importance on, you know, did they win this cup competition?
It's interesting you say that, bearing in mind Guardiola's comments after the game on Saturday. You know, that he was saying the Premier League is harder to win than Champions League. You know, in the Champions League, you can have 7 good games, 1 bad, and you're out, is how he put it. Whereas in every league, as you're saying, Nico, there has to be that consistency. You have to stay there. Would you agree with that, Chris? It does feel like we sort of almost undervalue a league win, but it feels like that's because of the quality of the league. So Manchester City have blown away all before them, but it's not their fault that Manchester United, Chelsea, etc. aren't up to the level. Whereas,
let me just put this forward. Like, before we were going, the Premier League is the most competitive league in the world. Now we're saying it was a cakewalk we had because he had a ton of money. Like, the conversation just always changes because Guardiola is there and he won something. It's like, I saw somebody go, he might be a decent manager, but, you know, he's a really good manager.
One of the greatest, yeah. Where do you sit on this one, Chris?
I think both statements can be true, in so much as it can be an achievement to win the Premier League, which it is. And I think it can also be true that for City, there is now a need for them to really try and push forward in Champions League. I would go even as far to say that they don't necessarily need to win it. They just need to be in that last four or that last two and sort of really. And I think that there is just an air of when I see Guardiola talk about the Champions League, him adhering to that, if you don't like the conversation or what's being said, change the conversation. And I think, yeah, the Premier League is obviously difficult to win. You have to go to some difficult places, not even just confined to the top six. Some of the away trips are very difficult. This fixture schedule can be difficult. But I do think that they're very different races in that sense. I think the Champions League, for them this year, it put them, ironically, against a team in the Premier League. So you could say that there's credence to what he says, because he was knocked out by an English team as opposed to someone from abroad. But I think that's the thing with the Champions League, is its difficulty is that you have to... is that the scope for failure is condensed to 180 minutes in the knockout rounds. And I think for him, that's something that we look at when he won it with Barcelona. Ever since, his record has been pretty poor in the competition by his own standards. Whether it's, you know, losing away, whether it's, I think his away record is like 5-23 now. The fact that he's only really kind of got to quarterfinals and semifinals. I actually think he's been to a final since that Barcelona team. I could be horribly wrong here, but 90% right. Sure that's the kid.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is that his early career was defined by the Champions League, much like Mourinho, you could argue. So I think that will always tail him, and he will always, to some degree, be defined by how he performs in that competition. And for City, I just think that, yeah, he hasn't really performed to the level required yet. And maybe in this instance, or this season, excuse me, they did do very well in the group stages. But to give a little bit of credence to what he said, you know, they couldn't maintain that consistency in the knockout rounds. And so ultimately, it counts for nothing more than a bit of padding on the DVD at the end of the season.
Yeah, I think we should move on from the Champions League topic. But my last thing to say about that is, like, the example that I'd like to give is a couple of years ago, I think it was Pellegrini. It wasn't Pellegrini's last season, but it was, maybe it was, I forget. Whatever year we had the lime green kits, I think we got to the last four of the Champions League. It was the first year with De Bruyne and Sterling and all them. And that team was fucking terrible, but we got farther in the Champions League because of the draws, and because we played a little bit more defensively, and we didn't care about possessing the ball as much. But we have this outward, you know, we have this outward image of more success in that year, even though you put that City team against this City team, and this City team blows that team away. So I don't know. Like I said, I think it's just far too random to. And I completely agree with Chris is saying in terms of Manchester City need to progress farther in that competition because of the image and where it puts them. But I just think that the weight that we as fans hold with it is a little bit too much sometimes.
How do you think Guardiola evolves Manchester City and makes them even better from here? Obviously, winning the Premier League title, I think next year will be about retaining that trophy and potentially progressing further in the Champions League. But what do you think he needs to do to improve this team? Do you think he needs to work on a plan B? It's something that Statman Dave said on last Thursday's podcast. I wish he could have been here for that, Nico. But he was talking about Guardiola's adaptability. Of course, he's got the commitment to his cause, to his philosophy. But do you think that flexibility, that plan B is something that he's missing and he could bring to this side next season to take them even further?
To an extent, I think. And I talked about this on the other podcast that I take a part in, which is Morons. It's a part of the team of John O'Shea's podcast network. But we kind of talked about how, you know, it does seem there is credence to the idea that Guardiola's style of football, possession dominant sort of style, does lend itself to more of a consistency in a league campaign where you're going to be playing a ton of games against similarly opponents of a similar quality, whereas the defensive football or the pressing football or the counterattacking football that Mourinho and Klopp play is more, there's more acceptance or there's more flexibility in terms of your ability to, I guess, put forth that style in a cup competition and be successful. That's why, you know, for example, international tournaments, I think a lot of the time you see more counterattacking football be more successful because it's easier to set up and you have less complexity to work with. And I think it's easy for someone like Dave to come across from the outside and be like, yep, he needs to play more defensively. But look at Manchester United this season. They didn't have a plan A even in the league, and they fell far short of their expectations pretty much at every competition. So every Manchester United fan out there, despite spending a ton of money, has not achieved what they're supposed to. So maybe they should have a plan A in the first place.
Yeah, speaking of the money, I mean, we're expecting City again to spend in the summer to bolster their squad. Where do you think is the key area where they need to improve? Is it perhaps midfield, where they've got the likes of David Silva, Fernandinho, who are in their early 30s, I think it's fair to say, we might see their game time managed next season? Is it elsewhere? Where do you think Guardiola needs to focus his potential spending power in the summer?
City's future is entirely dependent on where this midfield goes. Fernandinho played an insane amount of games in this stretch that we're talking about of losses. I think he played in all three or most of them. I think he's played over like 12,000 minutes this season. It's crazy how much he's played. And I think there's a stark contrast as to when he does play and when he doesn't play. Gundogan is a perfectly acceptable midfielder, but there is a real difference in the quality and style of play that those two midfielders bring, in terms of Fernandinho, through his positioning, through his intelligence, and through the way that he progresses the ball, stops a lot of, you know, defensive errors and defensive situations from entering sort of a danger zone. I think against Spurs, though they didn't have a ton of shots on target and didn't have a ton of concrete solid chances, there were little moments that required like last-ditch tackles from defenders that on a different day might not have happened. And that's because we played Gundogan in the midfield. He's simply not a defensive midfielder in the way that Fernandinho is. So City are approaching a crossroads, I guess, in some regard, where in the summer they either recruit an all-out sort of progressive passing midfielder that's just going to give them a ton of more chances, that if City managed to finish them, it's just going to be them scoring even more. Or do they try and recruit someone like Fernandinho, except maybe a little bit younger, that can prevent those defensive situations from becoming, you know, greater chances for other teams through their positioning? I think that's the crucial kind of decision that they need to make, and really if they can even find someone like that, because I think Fernandinho goes criminally underrated in terms of what he brings to the City team, and a lot of people saying, you know, he just passes it sideways. He does so much more than that. So I think that's kind of the summer recruitment big headline.
Let's talk about Newcastle United, shall we? 10th in the Premier League after beating Arsenal 2-1 at St James's Park yesterday. A fourth win in a row for Rafa Benitez's side. Pretty much guarantees them safety in the Premier League. They're now 41 points. Incredible stuff, Chris. Incredible run they've been on recently.
Yeah, a really good run. They've managed to take points off teams that were around them in Southampton and Huddersfield, and then teams in the top half, Leicester and Arsenal, which is something they weren't doing in the first half of the season. In fact, I think going into the Leicester game, they'd only taken one point off a team in the top half, which is Liverpool. They had done really well. Actually, I stand corrected, that'll have been 4 points because they beat Man United as well. They've done really well. I think they're a very efficient side. Defensively, they're very well organised. And I think that spreads throughout the team. Their ability to sort of just give up possession, but at the same time, when they get the ball, not instantly gift it back, is, I think, fairly beneficial to them. And part of the reason why they're able to take on teams like Arsenal and hit them, I would say, kind of on the counter-attack, because the first goal exploits the high line. The second one, I think, just exploits general disorganisation from Arsenal. But in both instances, they're all very fluid moves from the team involving 2, 3, 4 players.
Obviously, I mean, we've just spoken about how we can't undermine Pep Guardiola's achievements at Manchester City. Just in the same breath, we can't really undermine Rafa Benitez's achievements. I mean, a lot of people with the squad they have were expecting Newcastle to go down. Benitez himself obviously spoke in January about his dissatisfaction with his side. So for him, now almost mathematically, to keep them safe, it is a fantastic achievement. We can't really just brush aside, Chris.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I think the players he bought in the summer were a direct consequence of the budget he had. And I think there was a huge miscommunication and dare I even say maybe misleading of how much money he was given or would be given. And so the likes of Manquillo, the likes of Hosolu, they were never players that he wanted. You move to January, he gets given, I think, a bit more flexibility because of the position they were in. And you see Dubravka come in, who has been a revelation in goal, just as he wanted a good goalkeeper to come in the summer and wasn't allowed. Kennedy comes in as he wanted in the summer again, but Chelsea wouldn't release him. And then even now, sort of, I would say Slimani, who was somewhat influential yesterday, that to me points to the fact that he does seem to have a good eye for what he's trying to bring in and what the team needs more specifically, instead of just needless spending and investment. So I think he's done a very good job. He's taken them up into the top half and safety with games to go, which means they can kind of enjoy this last part of the season. And yeah, I think all he's done really is shown that he's a very, very good football manager. And you don't want to project too far forward because, you know, the club is consistently inconsistent. But I think if they could get some kind of new ownership with a little bit of financial clout, then yeah, they could potentially do something really exciting and I think take pages from Burnley's book in that sense.
I mean, that is the question. Where do they go from here? Do you think he will stay this summer? Does it all depend on that potential investment? Does it depend on promises made about the potential spending on the squad, etc.?
I think he stays another year. In fact, I seem to remember reading as much that he's guaranteed them another year, which is great news from a Newcastle perspective. I think he will expect more money. And yet, at the same time, I think he expected money when he got them promoted, because that is a hugely difficult thing to do. You just need to look at this season, the teams that went down, Sunderland, Hull, and my mind is completely blanking on the third one, Middlesbrough, I think it was, who have by no means stormed the league. And in fact, Sunderland are on the cusp of League One. Hull were in and around the relegation places or just above them up until fairly recently. And so, yeah, I think if I could almost give one piece of advice, it would be that Mike Ashley, I think, needs to stop playing games. He just needs to accept that the best way to sell this football club for even close to what he wants is to have it performing on the field. And I think one of the important aspects of Amanda Staveley's bid, whether genuine or not, was the continuity of Rafa Benitez's position at the club. She wanted him involved, and I think anyone who buys that football club will want Rafa Benitez involved, because he has a very calming influence, I think, on the football club overall. And I think if you were to bring a new ownership in and the sort of myriad of changes that would follow suit, he's someone that could oversee that and keep things fairly relaxed on the pitch, because no matter what's gone on this year with the potential buyout, the failed buyout, the talk of no transfer funds, some transfer funds, even, you know, I remember they bid on loan for Daniel Sturridge and then find out he's rejected them to go to West Brom. He doesn't panic, Benitez. He then just moves on and he gets Slimani, and it turns out to be a significantly better deal. And it's things like that where I think, yeah, that's the kind of calmness and serenity that football club has needed for a long, long time.
It's crazy because I was watching, I think it was during the Champions League tie, but I was watching the Real Madrid game and I was like, remember when Rafa Benitez managed this team? I mean, is there any circumstance, Chris, given the success that he's had with this club, that you think maybe greener pastures? There's plenty of club openings, I think, elsewhere.
There has been this gesture. I assume because they've just beaten the Gunners, but a lot of suggestion in the newspapers today that, you know, Arsenal could do a lot worse than Rafa Benitez.
Yeah, I think that's been one of the concerns almost from the minute he arrived. I mean, West Ham were talked about very consistently as a club sort of on that same level, who have aspirations and would want to bring him in and would give him the freedom that he kind of craves. Because I think underlying everything, that's the thing that Rafa wants. He wants the freedom to enact his vision. And I think he kind of wants to be appreciated as well without overtly stating as much. And I think I look at Liverpool, another club that he's very, very close to and you know, attends the Hillsborough Memorials and these kind of things. I think that relationship is found on the fact that Liverpool fans appreciated him. They still appreciate him. They still talk very highly of him. But I look at his time at Real Madrid. I look at maybe his time at Napoli, Chelsea. They're all clubs who kind of just took him for granted a little bit. Like they all, to me at least, when I looked at it, they all saw him as someone who kind of wasn't worthy or wasn't fit for the position, for whatever reason. And I think for me, when I look at the situation with Newcastle, I can't see a day where that happens. I just think that the supporters are so self-aware now, having gone through what they've gone through, that if he doesn't stay the year they go down, there's every chance that they're in Sunderland's position right now. There's every chance that they're still in the Championship in mid-table. But he sort of just pulled them away as they were sort of near the cliff face. And I think in terms of tempting him away, I wouldn't want to suffer from hubris and say that that's impossible. I just think that this job offers the right kind of balance of what he wants. So as long as he's placated financially with budgets and such like, I don't think that that will be an issue.
Let's talk the Champions League draw. It happened on Friday. Obviously, myself and Dave did a little reaction to the games from midweek, but we didn't get a chance to talk about the semi-final draw. We got to start, Nico. Liverpool versus Roma. You'd have to say Jurgen Klopp's preferred draw, although perhaps not as easy as it initially presents itself. How do you feel about this one, tactically speaking?
Is it the preferred draw, Adam? Because I think as I'm writing this week, you know, the Manchester City draw, I think a lot of people joked about it when it initially happened, but it was in my eyes, and I said this as soon as the draw happened, you know, welcome to the semifinals Liverpool Football Club, because yeah, the dynamic favors them. We were talking about a little bit before about the styles of football, and Liverpool, I don't think, can be the underdog in this situation. And I think they love being that. They love, because a lot of what their style of football sort of, it melds into the philosophy and the things that we know about Jurgen Klopp and all these things. But they do thrive in chaos. They do thrive in creating transition for other teams. They like messing with the spacing because they have Sadio Mane and Mohamed Salah and Roberto Firmino that can isolate defenders and destroy them and then make them look like garden gnomes and whatever you want to call them. But they, I don't know if they can do that against Roma. I think Roma have the ability, given, you know, the dynamic between these clubs, to take the lesser, I guess, you know, lesser onus of possession or not one at all, and thrive in that. But at the same time, I don't think they will. I think a lot of people talking about the legitimacy of the beating of Barcelona. And I mean, yes, they beat them fairly and squarely on the day. But, you know, I think I would have rather seen Barcelona come through. I don't think Roma are a very good side this year. And I think regardless of the dynamic, I imagine Liverpool will go through. But I could be wrong. You know, who knows?
Would you rather play Roma or Real Madrid over two legs? That's the question, Chris. Obviously, they're going to meet Real Madrid or Bayern in the final if they do get past Roma, but it feels like, you know, is this a preferred draw, if you see what I'm saying? Would you rather not play Real Madrid over two legs, have that home leg at Anfield? In the final, anything could happen. What are your thoughts going into this one? Who's your money on?
My head kind of leans just towards Liverpool a bit, but I think that could be just an English bias because I've been fortunate enough to see them more. I think when I compare Roma Real Madrid, I think Roma are actually really unlucky in the first leg against Barcelona, whereas Real Madrid have had these periods during the knockout phases where they haven't looked that convincing, and you know they have really struggled. And you go back even to the group stages where Tottenham had the beating of them, I would say fairly comfortably, in terms of once they got their game plan stamped onto the game. The absence of Ramos, I think, would heavily sway my decision at the same time, because I think that's the thing with Roma. Yes, the comeback was fantastic, but I think what surprised me, kind of impressed me about Eusebio Di Francesco, is he himself said he stayed up until, I think, 5 o'clock in the morning, kind of redesigning the team and redesigning the tactics of everything. And it did certainly have influences or similarities to the way that Conte tried to play against Barcelona, and really did stifle them. And I look at Liverpool in the same way and think, could he then come up with that again? Could he reproduce that ingenuity, that fresh idea to stifle a Liverpool attack that is so devastating? I think that will be the fantastic game, personally. If I'm speaking purely from an entertainment standpoint, the idea of Roma and Liverpool is oh, yeah, I can't wait to see that game.
Gonna be tasty.
But I think, yeah, if Liverpool are able to get through to the final, and we presume that Real Madrid do the same, not that I think it's a clear and shut case against Bayern, I would absolutely fancy Liverpool's chances against Real Madrid.
What questions can Roma pose of Liverpool, Nico? Because I caught a bit of the derby last night, the Rome derby. Obviously, the Roma players, they looked a bit tired, looked a bit drained from their exertions earlier in midweek. So perhaps they've got that excuse. But Kostas Manolas coming off, we don't know the extent of that injury. Dzeko looked a little bit blunt up there. Of course, it remains to be seen how they're going to set up against Liverpool. But it sort of feels like it's going to be difficult for them to ask questions of Jurgen Klopp's side.
Yeah, 100%. Like I was saying before, I just think, like you're saying there with Ed and Dzeko, if they do play him, if he does get to play, you know, they have the tools to deal with that. Virgil van Dijk is a very physically astute player. You know, he can kind of silence him in his ability to link up with some of the other Roma players. They have Raja Nainggolan from midfield, who's very good, but at the same time, they have perfectly capable midfielders that are able to deal with that. It's difficult for me to see a way past that, especially since Roma's defense has been so fragile this season. And if Kostas Manolas, who I think is probably their best defender, is out, then regardless of how they play, whether it be five at the back or four at the back or whatever, it's so difficult to contain Liverpool's front three, a great podcast, because of that speed and that pace and the situations that they put them in. So I just, you know, I haven't seen a ton of Roma, but what I have seen of them does not give me any confidence of their ability to threaten Liverpool. But like I was saying before, if they do take on this onus of being the lesser team and just look to counterattack Liverpool, Liverpool do not have the most amazing possession game. If they have to create of themselves, then they try to create transition. And if Liverpool don't allow them to do that, then that's one thing. But I just don't see it happening.
Well, sounds like Liverpool through to the final. Then the question is, who are they going to meet? Is it going to be Real Madrid? Is it going to be Bayern Munich? Obviously, a rematch of the same fixture last year. Who do you see going through in this one, Chris? Because it feels we're talking a lot about how Real Madrid are peaking at the right time once again in the latter stage of this competition, at the right stage of the season.
Not just Real Madrid, Ronaldo peaking.
Of course, many people considering them the favourites for this competition right now. I feel like we're overlooking slightly the fact that Juventus scored 3 goals against them at the Santiago Bernabeu.
Yeah,
did they not expose the weaknesses there that perhaps Bayern Munich can exploit?
I think, yeah, you almost took the words right out of my mouth there, that the second legs of Bayern and Real Madrid's ties make it like so impossible for me to honestly predict this, if I'm speaking really honestly, because Real Madrid looked really poor without Ramos. Like, really poor, I thought. They were exploited time and again by Juventus, and the penalty, for what it's worth, was a penalty in my eyes, but again, that is such a fine margin to win a tie on, and yet I thought Bayern would get Sevilla back to home turf and really just put a little bit of gloss on it like they did against Besiktas, but they couldn't. Now, I think some of that has to go to credit to Sevilla, but also I just wonder if maybe the scale is, that's the problem, is that when I look at the sort of seesaw of momentum, I don't see a huge difference in the two of them. I don't see Real Madrid storming ahead because of how they performed against Juventus in the same way I don't see Besiktas either.
So it feels like finalist predictions were saying Real Madrid versus Liverpool. Is that what we're going for?
100%. I think Real Madrid, the second tie against Juventus was a bit of a fluke, as Chris was saying there. Without Ramos, they look like a different team. Especially, you know, if you look at how Real Madrid defend, they force their defenders to make a lot of plays. And if you have a center back combination of Rafael Varane and Sergio Ramos, they're going to make plays, as well as Carvajal and Marcelo. And I think Bayern Munich, they've done well to get this far in the competition, but they haven't faced the most difficult of opposition getting there. And I think, you know, there was a opening, you know, 15, 20 minutes in the Juventus tie where Real Madrid created some really good chances. And I think had they gone in, it would have been a completely different game, probably not the comeback that we were all looking at for a while there. But as you're saying, as we were kind of talking about before, Ronaldo peaking at the right time, I think they'll definitely go through to the final. And then Liverpool versus Real Madrid final, Real Madrid winners.
that will be very tasty indeed. Bit old school. It's got a nice old school flavour. Chris, Real Madrid winners. We'll call it now.
Yeah, but honestly, I'm flipping a coin on this one. There's no, excuse me. There's no team jumping out to me. It's very much a picked on the spur at the moment.
Before we go, then, any other business from the weekend's football? We did see Chelsea mount a comeback against Southampton at Stamford Bridge. They were 2-0 up, the Saints, but another defeat. Looks like they could potentially be going down now, Nico.
Yeah, I mean, of the teams that I predicted at the beginning of the season on this very podcast to struggle and go down, I mean, I said West Ham, which has been relatively correct. I said Stoke, which has been, unfortunately for Elliot Hackney, friend of the podcast, been correct. But Southampton, I expected to push on because I think, although, and I said this very publicly, I think the decision to sack Puel was ill-advised because, you know, he fits with their style of football. Had a cup final gone differently, then it would have been a very successful season in a lot of people's eyes. Their decision to appoint the manager that they did, Pellegrino, I think was in the right sort of mindset because they wanted more attacking football. They wanted more chances to be created because they had struggled with scoring goals for a long time. And if you look at the squad, it's a very, very good team. And I think just sometimes things can go wrong. I know that sounds like a very ambiguous answer, but at the same time, I think there have been a lot of situations this year where they've been unlucky. I don't necessarily think that's the case with this Chelsea game. I know Chris had a lot of thoughts about their particularly poor defending, but this has been the case for Southampton for almost 2 years now. They haven't been able to score a ton of goals, and I think that's partially down to the inconsistency they've had at the striker position. Charlie Austin is not the most reliable guy in terms of fitness. When he is fit, he's very good, but in terms of fitness and keeping someone in there, I think they've lacked that since Graziano Pella has made his move to China. But it's just honestly a travesty to see such a team. You know, if they lose this next game, I think it's almost guaranteed. But if, you know, to see a team filled with really, really talented individuals and a club that has made all the right moves in making sure that their progress into the Premier League is sustainable, you know, it's such a shame to see them possibly going down, because I think of all the other teams that have mismanaged and made the wrong moves, like a West Ham or other guys, you know, you would rather see them go down than a Southampton, I think, in many people's eyes. So I just think it's, if they do end up going down, it'll be probably something that I don't want to remember.
Can I just say, in regards to Southampton, Virgil van Dijk, kingmaker, absolutely. I think you look at the improvement in Liverpool, the drop in Southampton, he seems so influential this season for me.
What else do you have this weekend? PSG winning the title, nothing like a 7-1 win over Monaco to confirm it. I don't know if you saw the trending topic in France. The number one trending topic yesterday was hashtag Hatem champion, to try and convince Unai Emery to play Ben Arthur for at least 1 minute so he could be the champion too.
Yeah, did you see, I think he posted on his Instagram a while back that it was a little cupcake or like a brownie or something, and it said, this marks the 1 year mark since I haven't played for PSG.
Yeah.
It was interesting. I think there was also a story I read that in the January transfer window, the, you know, sporting director told him, the manager doesn't want you, you're not going to play, you know, we have found buyers for you. I think one of them was his former club Nice. Even Mario Balotelli got on the phone and was like, just come back, play some football, it'll be a good time. And he was like, nope, I don't want to go. So I think this is, and Chris has more experience with this player than I think most of us do, being a Newcastle United fan and supporter and someone that's covered them. But he's extremely frustrating because I think this is probably the last couple years of relevancy in his career. And he is a brilliant player, and he did earn that move to PSG. He was really good for Nice for a season. But it's just kind of, it's interesting to see the difference in professionalism that you see in some players, how they treat the severity of how good they are versus others that are, you know, making jokes out of it and actively pissing off the manager and stuff like that.
What about Wolves as well this weekend, Chris?
Kanye did it.
Kanye
Wolves.
Did it. You went viral, basically, Chris, did you not?
I wouldn't go that far.
Who did the tweet first?
A very old joke.
Who did the tweet first, you or Elliot Agnew? That's what I want to know.
The thing is, we both had similar phrasing and didn't see each other's.
Great minds and all that.
Yeah. That's definitely what I'll claim. They managed to get promoted without even kicking a ball because Fulham and Brentford drew 1-1 on Saturday evening. And then they just got to put a gloss on it with a fairly comfortable win against Birmingham the next day. I remember in the preseason not really talking about them as champions candidates or anything like that. There was certainly a lot of intrigue around Wolves because, you know, there's the talk of Jorge Mendes becoming an advisor, then Hotter arrives, then Neves arrives, Willy Bawley arrives, and then Nuno comes in as head coach. And they're very difficult to predict those kind of situations and whether the team can establish consistency. I think that's the most difficult thing to truly work out. But credit to Wolves, you know, they've never lost a game this season that they've taken the lead in. They've just never really battered teams either at the same instance. There's never been like a 6 or a 7. But they've been, I would say, comfortable for most of the season. The quality of Neves, Hotter has always shone through. Even guys like Connor Cody, to be fair, has been really good in the heart of defence, having been converted from more of a midfield type. They didn't have it all their own way. And I think next season will be really fascinating to watch because the obvious thought is that more Mendes clients will arrive. Renato Sanchez is one of his clients, interestingly. I think, to me at least, there's a certain argument to be made that this could be the future of how foreign investors seek out English football clubs, because the cost, I would say, is a lot more. It's a lot more financially efficient to buy a club in the second tier or even the third tier and take them up through the leagues. We saw it many years ago with Notts County. Obviously, that went horribly wrong, so it's not without its horror stories. But I think you look at Wolves as a case of, you can afford the right advisors, in inverted commas, then everything will be fine.
Finally, I'm sure you've seen this, Nico. The now infamous Etisalat congratulatory video, the Manchester City sponsors.
Let's not talk about that.
The video that went viral. The one thing I'd say about it is, of course, it's made in conjunction with the club, but I think it's a little bit harsh, maybe a little bit silly to attribute it to the club. It's obviously the sponsor that have made and produced this video. Yes, it's embarrassing. Yes, it's cringeworthy, but it's separate from the football club itself. I bet Manchester City, well, I would say Manchester City wished it hadn't been released yesterday.
I think it's just the hyper-capitalization of the game. Like, they have to, this massive company that is looking to,
yes,
or is a part of City Football Group, like, they have a celebration video ready that's, you know, in some way, shape, or form, subconsciously influencing you to do something that provides some form of monetary compensation for City Football Group. It's just, that's what it is. All these clubs, they do the same thing. They'll continue to do the same thing. It's not great. I didn't enjoy it. I don't think there's a City fan.
I don't think anyone enjoyed it apart from Man United fans.
I don't think the people who made it enjoyed it. It's just, it is what it is, isn't it?
Yeah. The best part, I think, was I'd seen on Reddit people pointing out that the sort of the section in the pub where they're talking about if you're happy and that they did it, stomp your feet. They're drinking water instead of pints because obviously the company's from the UAE.
Nice.
They don't want to show their alcohol consumption. Also, before we go, of course,
could have been a pint of vodka. You never know.
That's true. Maybe they're promoting excessive alcohol consumption. Before we go, the defeat to West Brom at Old Trafford did confirm the title for Manchester City when Manchester United lost on Sunday. The interesting fact is that's the first time Jose Mourinho hasn't won a title in his second season at a club. Obviously, it's all over for him now, Nico. Mourinho's done. He's finished.
He's finished. He's off.
That's the only conclusion we can reach from this.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think it's interesting, as I've said before. Maybe given how the club have acted over the past couple of weeks, because I know we did talk about this like a month ago, and I did say that it was difficult for me to see Mourinho at the club next year. And I think given how the club have acted, they'll probably stick with it another year. But
still be there.
I don't know. It has to be. I'm curious to hear what you guys have to say. But I mean, it has to be disappointing for. I mean, they stopped Manchester City from winning it against them, but then they. In a probably more embarrassing fashion, just lost to what has been the team that has been basically secured, nailed on, relegated since January, and handing it.
It would have been more acceptable to lose to Manchester City at the end, in many ways.
It's like, fine, they've been good all year, but you lose to J. Rodriguez header. That's great.
Yeah, I think it does put the pressure on Mourinho even more so, and I think it does sort of cap what has been a pretty mixed season. I think obviously they've got the FA Cup semi-final this weekend against Spurs. I think, you know, in context, they finished second. They could still win the FA Cup. But I think, you know, just as we're sort of saying, we can't diminish the achievements of Guardiola.
If Tottenham knocked them out of the FA Cup, what
is open. He's open. I think Mourinho will still be there, but I think that will compound what has been a pretty dramatic change in opinion and a change in the atmosphere around Old Trafford and around Mourinho. I think at the start of the season, when they were blowing away teams at home especially, and when they looked like they might be able to compete with Manchester City and we might have a title race on, I think there was a completely different opinion, a completely different view from Manchester United fans. I think that disillusionment that we've seen with Mourinho at past clubs in his second and third seasons has sort of started now at Manchester United. It's going to be interesting to see where he goes from here next season, whether they can compete for the title with City, who likely are just going to get even better. So
quickly, is there a title race next season? Is it close? Do we give a shit by this point of the year? 1 year from now, do we give a shit about the title still, or is it won?
I like to think Spurs and Liverpool are going to be closer to Manchester City. Manchester United, I think a lot depends on what happens in the summer. Same with Chelsea. If they bring in a new manager, I think a lot is going to depend on those sort of intangibles at the moment. But I like to think it's going to be a lot closer. But again, City could easily, just as easily pull away if they spend another what, 100, 200 million. But I think a lot's going to depend on this summer. Shall we wrap up there, guys? Another fantastic Front Free podcast. I'm sure you'll all agree. For now, Nico, where can the listeners find you before the next podcast?
They can find me on Twitter at @Nico_O'Morales, also on iTunes at this wonderful podcast, The Front Three. And also, if they search A Team of John O'Shea's podcast, there's the series that I do with John McKenzie is called Morons. We talk about abstract football subjects and also football.
So go search titled, I'm sure you'll all agree. good blood. Go and check that out, guys. We'll leave the link in the description. Chris, where can listeners find you? Anything to plug this week?
Nope, nothing of note. @KHENEAGE.
Love your stuff, guys. You can find me on Twitter @AdamBoltwood. Do subscribe to The Front Three. Do get your reviews.
And listeners, go watch an EXO video.
Yeah, there you go. We've got a really interestingly titled one up from yesterday. You can see some great reactions from Lawrence McKenna to the Champions League semi-final legs, which is sure to bring a smile to your face. Guys, we'll see you on the next podcast. Until then, have a bloody great week. That's a magic number. Yes, it is. It's the magic number. Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.